fingers, saying, "Wear her always as you grow, because all the hard days are coming." She had worn it all right. At Our Lady of Angels Grammar and Middle School, she had worn it. Then at St. Vincent de Paul High. She wore the medal until breasts grew around it like ordinary miracles. And then someplace, probably on the class trip to Hampton Beach, she had lost it. Coming home on the bus, she had tongue-kissed for the first time. Butch Susie had been the boy, and she'd been able to taste the cotton candy he'd eaten. Mary on that long-gone medallion and Mary on this billboard had exactly the same look, the one that made you feel guilty of thinking impure thoughts, even when all you were thinking about was a peanut butter sandwich. Beneath Mary, the sign said, "Mother of Mercy Charities, help the Florida homeless. Won't you help us?" "Hey there, Mary, what's the story?" More than one voice this time, many voices, girls' voices, chanting ghost voices. These were ordinary miracles. There were also ordinary ghosts. You found these things out as you got older. "What's wrong with you?" She knew that voice as well as she did the eyebrow and dimple look. Bill's "I'm only pretending to be pissed" tone of voice, the one that meant he really was pissed, at least a little. "Nothing," she gave him the best smile she could manage. "You really don't seem like yourself. Maybe you shouldn't have slept on the plane." "You're probably right," she said, "and not just to be agreeable either. After all, how many women got a second honeymoon on Captiva Island for their 25th anniversary? Round trip on a chartered Learjet? 10 days at one of those places where your money was no good, at least until MasterCard coughed up the bill at the end of the month. And if you wanted a massage, a big Swedish babe would come and pummel you in your 6-room beach house. Things had been different at the start. Bill, whom she'd first met at a crosstown high school dance and then met again at college 3 years later, another ordinary miracle, had begun their married life working as a janitor, because there were no openings in the computer industry. It was 1973, and computers were essentially going nowhere, and they were living in a grotty place in Revere, not on the beach, but close to it, and all night people kept going up the stairs to buy drugs from the two sallow creatures who lived in the apartment above them and listened endlessly to dopey records from the 60s. Carol used to lie awake waiting for the shouting to start, thinking, "We won't ever get out of here. We'll grow old and die within earshot of Cream and Blue Cheer and the Dodgem cars down on the beach." Bill, exhausted at the end of his shift, would sleep through the noise lying on his side, sometimes with one hand on her hip, and when it wasn't there, she often put it there, especially if the creatures upstairs were arguing with their customers. Bill was all she had. Her parents had practically disowned her when she married him. He was a Catholic, but the wrong sort of Catholic. Graham had asked why she wanted to go with that boy when anyone could tell he was shanty. How could she fall for all his foolish talk? Why did she want to break her father's heart? And what could she say? It was a long distance from that place in Revere to a private jet soaring at 41,000 feet. A long way to this rental car, which was a Crown Victoria, what the good fellows in the gangster movies invariably called a Crown Vic, heading for 10 days in a place where the tab would probably be, well, she didn't even want to think about it. "Floyd. Oh, shit." "Carol, what is it now?" "Nothing," she said. Up ahead by the road was a little pink bungalow, the porch flanked by palms. Seeing those trees with their fringy heads lifted against the blue sky made her think of Japanese Zeros coming in low, their underwing machine guns firing. Such an association, clearly the result of a youth misspent in front of the TV. And as they passed, a black woman would come out. She would be drying her hands on a piece of pink toweling and would watch them expressionlessly as they passed. Rich folks in a Crown Vic headed for Captiva, and she'd have no idea that Carol Shelton once lay awake in a $90-a-month apartment, listening to the records and the drug deals upstairs, feeling something alive inside her, something that made her think of a cigarette that had fallen down behind the drapes at a party, small and unseen, but smoldering away next to the fabric. "Hun?" "Nothing," I said. They passed the house. There was no woman. An old man, white, not black, sat in a rocking chair, watching them pass. There were rimless glasses on his nose and a piece of ragged pink toweling, the same shade as the house, across his lap. "I'm fine now. Just anxious to get there and change into some shorts." His hand touched her hip, where he had so often touched her during those first days, and then crept a little farther inland. She thought about stopping him. Roman hands and Russian fingers, they used to say, and didn't. They were, after all, on their second honeymoon. Also, it would make that expression go away. "Maybe," he said, "we could take a pause, you know, after the dress comes off and before the shorts go on." "I think that's a lovely idea," she said, and put her hand over his, pressed both more tightly against her. Ahead was a sign that would read Palm House 3 miles on left when they got close enough to see it. The sign actually read Palm House 2 miles on left. Beyond it was another sign, Mother Mary again, with her hands outstretched and that little electric shimmy that wasn't quite a halo around her head. This version read, "Mother of Mercy Charities, help the Florida sick. Won't you help us?" Bill said, "The next one ought to say Burma Shave." She didn't understand what he meant, but it was clearly a joke, and so she smiled. The next one would say, "Mother of Mercy Charities, help the Florida hungry," but she couldn't tell him that. Dear Bill. Dear in spite of his sometimes stupid expressions and his sometimes unclear allusions. "He'll most likely leave you, and you know something? If you go through with it, that's probably the best luck you can expect." This according to her father. Dear Bill, who had proved that just once, just that one crucial time, her judgment had been far better than her father's. She was still married to the man her Graham had called the big boaster. At a price, true, but what was that old axiom? God says, take what you want and pay for it. Her head itched. She scratched at it absently, watching for the next Mother of Mercy billboard. Horrible as it was to say, things had started turning around when she lost the baby. That was just before Bill got a job with Beach Computers out on Route 128. That was when the first winds of change in the industry began to blow. Lost the baby. Had a miscarriage. They all believed that, except maybe Bill. Certainly her family had believed it. Dad, Mom, Graham. Miscarriage was the story they told. Miscarriage was a Catholic story, if ever there was one. "Hey, Mary, what's the story?" They had sometimes sung when they skipped rope, feeling daring, feeling sinful. The skirts of their uniforms flipping up and down over their scabby knees. That was at Our Lady of Angels, where Sister Annunciata would spank your knuckles with her ruler if she caught you gazing out the window during sentence time, where Sister Dormitilla would tell you that 1,000,000 years was the first tick of eternity's endless clock, and you could spend eternity in hell. Most people did. It was easy. In hell, you would live forever with your skin on fire and your bones roasting. Now she was in Florida. Now she was in a Crown Vic sitting next to her husband, whose hand was still in her crotch. The dress would be wrinkled, but who cared if it got that look off his face? And why wouldn't the feeling stop? She thought of a mailbox with Raglan painted on the side and an American flag decal on the front. And although the name turned out to be Reagan and the flag a Grateful Dead sticker, the box was there. She thought of a small black dog trotting briskly along the other side of the road, its head down, sniffling, and the small black dog was there. She thought again of the billboard, and yes, there it was. Mother of Mercy Charities helped the Florida hungry. Won't you help us? Bill was pointing. There, see? I think that's Palm House. No, not where the billboard is, the other side. Why did they let people put those things up out here anyway? I don't know. Her head itched. She scratched, and black dandruff began falling past her eyes. She looked at her fingers and was horrified to see dark smudges on the tips. It was as if someone had just taken her fingerprints. Bill? She raked her hand through her blonde hair, and this time the flakes were bigger. She saw they were not flakes of skin, but flakes of paper. There was a face on one, peering out of the char like a face peering out of a botched negative. Bill? What? What? Then a total change in his voice, and that frightened her more than the way the car swerved. Christ, honey, what's in your hair? The face appeared to be Mother Teresa's, or was that just because she'd been thinking about Our Lady of Angels? Carol plucked it from her dress, meaning to show it to Bill, and it crumpled between her fingers before she could. She turned to him and saw that his glasses were melted to his cheeks. One of his eyes had popped from its socket and then split like a grape pumped full of blood. And I knew it, she thought. Even before I turned, I knew it. Because I had that feeling. A bird was crying in the trees. On the billboard, Mary held out her hands. Carol tried to scream. Tried to scream. Carol? It was Bill's voice, coming from 1,000 miles away. Then his hand, not pressing the folds of her dress into her crotch, but on her shoulder. You okay, babe? She opened her eyes to brilliant sunlight and her ears to the steady hum of the Learjet's engines. And something else, pressure against her eardrums. She looked from Bill's mildly concerned face to the dial below the temperature gauge in the cabin and saw that it had wound down to 28,000. Landing? She said, sounding muzzy to herself. Already? It's fast, huh? Sounding pleased, as if he had flown it himself instead of only paying for it. Pilot says we'll be on the ground in Fort Myers in 20 minutes. You took a hell of a jump, girl. I had a nightmare. He laughed. The plummy, ain't you the silly Billy laugh she had come really to detest. No nightmares allowed on your second honeymoon, babe. What was it? I don't remember, she said. And it was the truth. There were only fragments. Bill with his glasses melted all over his face, and one of the 3 or 4 forbidden skip rhymes they had sometimes chanted back in 5th and 6th grade. This one had gone, "Hey there, Mary, what's the story?" And then something, something, something. She couldn't come up with the rest. She could remember jangle, tangle, jingle, bingle. I saw Daddy's great big dingle, but she couldn't remember the one about Mary. Mary helps the Florida sick, she thought, with no idea of what the thought meant. And just then there was a beep as the pilot turned the seatbelt light on. They had started their final descent. Let the wild rumpus start, she thought, and tightened her belt. You really don't remember? He asked, tightening his own. The little jet ran through a cloud filled with bumps. One of the pilots in the cockpit made a minor adjustment, and the ride smoothed out again. Because usually, just after you wake up, you can still remember, even the bad ones. I remember Sister Nunciata from Our Lady of Angels, sentence time. Now that's a nightmare. 10 minutes later, the landing gear came down with a whine and a thump. 5 minutes after that, they landed. They were supposed to bring the car right out to the plane, Bill said, already starting up the type A shit. This she didn't like, but at least she didn't detest it the way she detested the plummy laugh and his repertoire of patronizing looks. I hope there hasn't been a hitch. There hasn't been, she thought, and the feeling swept over her full force. I'm going to see it out the window on my side in just a second or two. It's your total Florida vacation car, a great big white goddamn Cadillac, or maybe it's a Lincoln. And yes, here it came, proving what? Well, she supposed it proved that sometimes when you had déjà vu, what you thought was going to happen next really did. It wasn't a Caddy or a Lincoln after all, but a Crown Victoria, what the gangsters in a Martin Scorsese film would doubtless call a Crown Vic. "Whew," she said, as he helped her down the steps and off the plane. The hot sun made her feel dizzy. "What's wrong?" "Nothing, really. I've got déjà vu, left over from my dream, I guess. We've been here before, that kind of thing." "It's being in a strange place, that's all," he said, and kissed her cheek. "Come on, let the wild rumpus start." They went to the car. Bill showed his driver's license to the young woman who had driven it out. Carol saw him check out the hem of her skirt, then sign the paper on her clipboard. "She's going to drop it," Carol thought. The feeling was now so strong it was like being on an amusement park ride that goes just a little too fast. All at once you realize you're edging out of the land of fun and into the kingdom of nausea. She'll drop it, and Bill will say, "Whoopsie-daisy," and pick it up for her, get an even closer look at her legs. But the Hertz woman didn't drop the clipboard. A white courtesy van had appeared to take her back to the Butler Aviation Terminal. She gave Bill a final smile, Carol, she had ignored completely, and opened the front passenger door. She stepped up, then slipped. "Whoopsie-daisy, don't be crazy," Bill said, and took her elbow, steadying her. She gave him a smile, he gave her well-turned legs a goodbye look, and Carol stood by the growing pile of their luggage and thought, "Hey there, Mary." "Mrs. Shelton?" It was the co-pilot. He had the last bag and the case with Bill's laptop inside it, and he looked concerned. "Are you all right? You're very pale." Bill heard and turned away from the departing white van, his face worried. If her strongest feelings about Bill were her only feelings about Bill, now that they were 25 years on, she would have left him when she found out about the secretary, a Clairol blonde too young to remember the Clairol slogan that started, "If I have only one life to live." But there were other feelings. There was love, for instance. Still, love. A kind that girls in Catholic school uniforms didn't suspect. A weedy, unlovely species too tough to die. Besides, it wasn't just love that held people together. There were secrets, and the price you paid to keep them. "Carol," he asked her. "Babe, all right?" She thought about telling him no, she wasn't all right. She was drowning. But then she managed to smile and said, "It's the heat, that's all. I feel a little groggy. Get me in the car and crank up the air conditioning. I'll be fine." Bill took her by the elbow. "Bet you're not checking out my legs, though," Carol thought. "You know where they go, don't you?" And led her toward the Crown Vic as if she were a very old lady. By the time the door was closed and cool air was pumping over her face, she actually had started to feel a little better. "If the feeling comes back, I'll tell him," Carol thought. "I'll have to. It's just too strong. Not normal." Well, déjà vu was never normal, she supposed. It was something that was part dream, part chemistry, and she was sure she'd read this, maybe in a doctor's office somewhere while waiting for her gynecologist to go prospecting up her 52-year-old twat. Part the result of an electrical misfire in the brain, causing new experience to be identified as old data. A temporary hole in the pipes, hot water and cold water mingling. She closed her eyes and prayed for it to go away. "O Mary, conceived without sin, pray for us who have recourse to thee." "Please, oh please," they used to say, "not back to parochial school. This was supposed to be a vacation, not..." "Floyd, what's that over there? Oh shit, oh shit!" Who was Floyd? The only Floyd Bill knew was Floyd Dorning, or maybe it was Darling, the kid he'd run the snack bar with, the one who'd run off to New York with his girlfriend. Carol couldn't remember when Bill had told her about that kid, but she knew he had. Just quit it, girl. There's nothing here for you. Slam the door on the whole train of thought. And that worked. There was a final whisper, "What's the story?" And then she was just Carol Shelton on her way to Captiva Island, on her way to Palm House with her husband, the renowned software designer, on their way to the beaches and the rum drinks and the sound of a steel band playing Margaritaville. They passed a Publix market. They passed an old black man minding a roadside fruit stand. He made her think of actors from the 30s and movies you saw on the American Movie Channel. An old Yasser boss type of guy wearing bib overalls and a straw hat with a round crown. Bill made small talk, and she made it right back at him. She was faintly amazed that the little girl who had worn a Mary medallion every day from 10 to 16 had become this woman in the Donna Karan dress. That the desperate couple in that Revere apartment were these middle-aged rich folks rolling down a lush aisle of palms. But she was, and they were. Once in those Revere days, he had come home drunk, and she had hit him and drawn blood from below his eye. Once she had been in fear of hell, had lain half-drugged in steel stirrups, thinking, "I'm damned. I've come to damnation, a million years, and that's only the first tick of the clock." They stopped at the Causeway toll booth, and Carol thought, the toll taker has a strawberry birthmark on the left side of his forehead, all mixed in with his eyebrow. There was no mark. The toll taker was just an ordinary guy in his late 40s or early 50s, iron gray hair and a buzz cut, horn-rimmed specs, the kind of guy who says, "Y'all have a nice time, okay?" But the feeling began to come back, and Carol realized that now the things she thought she knew were things she really did know. At first, not all of them. But then, by the time they neared the little market on the right side of Route 41, it was almost everything. The market's called Corson's, and there's a little girl out front, Carol thought. She's wearing a red pinafore. She's got a doll, a dirty old yellow-haired thing, that she's left on the store steps so she can look at a dog in the back of a station wagon. The name of the market turned out to be Carson's, not Corson's, but everything else was the same. As the white Crown Vic passed, the little girl in the red dress turned her solemn face in Carol's direction. A country girl's face. Although what a girl from the Tulies could be doing here in rich folks' tourist country, her and her dirty yellow-headed doll, Carol didn't know. "Here's where I ask Bill how much farther, only I won't do it, because I have to break out of this cycle, this groove. I have to." "How much farther?" she asked him. He says there's only one road, we can't get lost. He says he promises me we'll get to the Palm House with no problem. And by the way, who's Floyd? Bill's eyebrow went up, the dimple beside his mouth appeared. "Once you get over the causeway and on to Sanibel Island, there's only one road," he said. Carol barely heard him. He was still talking about the road, her husband who had spent a dirty weekend in bed with his secretary 2 years ago, risking all they had done and all they had made. Bill, doing that with his other face on, being the Bill Carol's mother had warned would break her heart. And later Bill trying to tell her he hadn't been able to help himself, her wanting to scream. "I once murdered a child for you, the potential of a child anyway. How high is that price? And is this what I get in return? To reach my 50s and find out that my husband had to get into some Clairol girl's pants?" "Tell him," she shrieked. "Make him pull over and stop. Make him do anything that will break you free. Change one thing. Change everything. You can do it. If you could put your feet up in those stirrups, you can do anything." But she could do nothing. And it all began to tick by faster. the two overfed crows lifted off from their splatter of lunch. Her husband asked why she was sitting that way. Was it a cramp? Her saying, yes, yes, a cramp in her back, but it was easing. Her mouth quacked on about déjà vu just as if she weren't drowning in it, and the Crown Vic moved forward like one of those sadistic Dodgem cars at Revere Beach. Here came Palmdale Motors on the right, and on the left, some kind of sign for the local community theater, a production of Naughty Marietta. No, it's Mary, not Marietta. Mary, Mother of Jesus, Mary, Mother of God, she's got her hands out. Carol bent all her will toward telling her husband what was happening, because the right Bill was behind the wheel. The right Bill could still hear her. Being heard was what married love was all about. Nothing came out. In her mind, Graham said, "All the hard days are coming." In her mind, a voice asked Floyd what was over there, then said, "Oh, shit," then screamed, "Oh, shit!" She looked at the speedometer and saw it was calibrated, not in miles an hour, but thousands of feet. They were at 28,000 and descending. Bill was telling her that she shouldn't have slept on the plane, and she was agreeing. There was a pink house coming up, little more than a bungalow, fringed with palm trees that looked like the ones you saw in the Second World War movies, fronds framing incoming Lear jets with their machine guns blazing. Blazing, burning hot. All at once, the magazine he's holding turns into a torch. Holy Mary, Mother of God. Hey there, Mary, what's the story? They passed the house. The old man sat on the porch and watched them go by. The lenses of his rimless glasses glinted in the sun. Bill's hand established a beachhead on her hip. He said something about how they might pause to refresh themselves between the doffing of her dress and the donning of her shorts, and she agreed, although they were never going to get to Palm House. They were going to go down this road and down this road. They were for the White Crown Vic, and the White Crown Vic was for them forever and ever. Amen. The next billboard would say Palm House, 2 miles. Beyond it was the one saying that Mother of Mercy Charities helped the Florida sick. Would they help her? Now that it was too late, she was beginning to understand. Beginning to see the light the way she could see the subtropical sun sparkling off the water on their left. Wondering how many wrongs she had done in her life, how many sins, if you like that word. God knew her parents, and her Graham certainly had. Sin this and sin that, and wear the medallion between those growing things the boys look at. And years later, she had lain in bed with her new husband on hot summer nights, knowing a decision had to be made. Knowing the clock was ticking, the cigarette butt was smoldering, and she remembered making the decision, not telling him out loud, because about some things you could be silent. Her head itched. She scratched it. Black flecks came swirling down past her face. On the Crown Vic's instrument panel, the speedometer froze at 16,000 feet and then blew out. But Bill appeared not to notice. Here came a mailbox with a Grateful Dead sticker pasted on the front. Here came a little black dog with its head down, trotting busily. And God, how her head itched! Black flakes drifting in the air like fallout, and Mother Teresa's face looking out of one of them. Mother of Mercy Charities, help the Florida hungry. Won't you help us? Floyd, what's that over there? Oh, shit! She has time to see something big, and to read the word Delta. Bill? Bill? His reply, clear enough but nevertheless coming from around the rim of the universe. Christ, honey, what's in your hair? She plucked the charred remnant of Mother Teresa's face from her lap, and held it out to him, the older version of the man she had married, The secretary-fucking man she had married, the man who had nonetheless rescued her from people who thought that you could live forever in paradise if you only lit enough candles and wore the blue blazer and stuck to the approved skipping rhymes. Lying there with this man one hot summer night, while the drug deals went on upstairs and Iron Butterfly sang Inagata De Vida for the 9 billionth time, she had asked what he thought you got, you know, after. When your part in the show was over, he had taken her in his arms and held her. Down the beach she heard the jangle jingle of the midway and the bang of the Dodgem cars, and Bill... Bill's glasses were melted to his face. One eye bulged out of its socket. His mouth was a blood hole. In the trees, a bird was crying. A bird was screaming. And Carol began to scream with it, holding out the charred fragment of paper with Mother Teresa's picture on it, screaming, watching as his cheeks turned black and his forehead swarmed and his neck split open like a poisoned goiter. Screaming. She was screaming. Somewhere, Iron Butterfly was singing Inagata De Vida, and she was screaming. Carol? It was Bill's voice from 1,000 miles away. His hand was on her, but it was concern in his touch rather than lust. She opened her eyes and looked around the sun-brilliant cabin of the Lear 35, and for a moment she understood everything, in the way one understands the tremendous import of a dream upon the first moment of waking. She remembered asking him what he believed you got, you know. After. And he had said, you probably got what you always thought you would get. That if Jerry Lee Lewis thought he was going to hell for playing Boogie Woogie, that's exactly where he'd go. Heaven, hell, or Grand Rapids, it was your choice. Or the choice of those who had taught you what to believe. It was the human mind's final great parlor trick. The perception of eternity in the place where you'd always expected to spend it. Carol, you okay, babe? In one hand was the magazine he'd been reading, a Newsweek, with Mother Teresa on the cover. Sainthood Now, it said in white. Looking around wildly at the cabin, she was thinking, it happens at 16,000 feet. I have to tell them. I have to warn them. But it was fading, all of it, the way those feelings always did. They went like dreams or cotton candy turning into a sweet mist just above your tongue. Landing? Already? She felt wide awake, but her voice sounded thick and muzzy. It's fast, huh? He said, sounding pleased, as if he'd flown it himself instead of paying for it. Floyd says we'll be on the ground in... Who? She asked. The cabin of the little plane was warm, but her fingers were cold. Who? Floyd, you know, the pilot. He pointed his thumb toward the cockpit's left-hand seat. They were descending into a scrim of clouds. The plane began to shake. He says we'll be on the ground in Fort Myers in 20 minutes. You took a hell of a jump, girl. And before that you were moaning. Carol opened her mouth to say it was that feeling, the one you could only say what it was in French, something vous or vous, but it was fading, and all she said was, I had a nightmare. There was a beep as Floyd, the pilot, switched the seatbelt light on. Carol turned her head. Somewhere below, waiting for them now and forever, was a white car from Hertz, a gangster car. The kind the characters in a Martin Scorsese movie would probably call a Crown Vic. She looked at the cover of the news magazine, at the face of Mother Teresa, and all at once she remembered skipping rope behind Our Lady of Angels, skipping to one of the forbidden rhymes, skipping to the one that went, Hey there, Mary, what's the story? Save my ass from purgatory. All the hard days are coming. her Gram had said. She had pressed the metal into Carol's palm, wrapped the chain around her fingers. The hard days are coming.
"1408," read by Stephen King.
"1408. 1. Mike Enslin was still in the revolving door when he saw Olin, the manager of the Hotel Dolphin, sitting in one of the overstuffed lobby chairs. Mike's heart sank. Maybe should have brought the lawyer along again after all, he thought. Well, too late now. And even if Olin decided to throw up another roadblock or two between Mike and room 1408, that wasn't all bad. There were compensations. Olin was crossing the room with one pudgy hand held out as Mike left the revolving door. The Dolphin was on 61st Street, around the corner from Fifth Avenue, small but smart. A man and woman dressed in evening clothes passed Mike as he reached for Olin's hand, switching his small overnight case to his left hand in order to do it. The woman was blonde, dressed in black, of course, and the light, flowery smell of her perfume seemed to summarize New York. On the mezzanine level, someone was playing Night and Day in the bar, as if to underline the summary. "Mr. Enslin, good evening." "Mr. Olin, is there a problem?" Olin looked pained. For a moment he glanced around the small, smart lobby as if for help. At the concierge stand, a man was discussing theater tickets with his wife, while the concierge himself watched them with a small, patient smile. At the front desk, a man with the rumpled look one only got after long hours in business class was discussing his reservation with a woman in a smart black suit that could itself have doubled for evening wear. It was business as usual at the Hotel Dolphin. There was help for everyone except poor Mr. Olin, who had fallen into the writer's clutches. "Mr. Olin," Mike repeated. "Mr. Enslin, could I speak to you for a moment in my office?" "Well, and why not?" It would help the section on room 1408 add to the ominous tone the readers of his book seemed to crave, and that wasn't all. Mike Enslin hadn't been sure until now, in spite of all the backing and filling. Now he was. Olin was really afraid of room 1408 and of what might happen to Mike there tonight. "Of course, Mr. Olin." Olin, the good host, reached for Mike's bag. "Allow me." "I'm fine with it," Mike said. "Nothing but a change of clothes and a toothbrush." "Are you sure?" "Yes," Mike said. "I'm already wearing my lucky Hawaiian shirt." He smiled. "It's the one with the ghost repellent." Olin didn't smile back. He sighed instead, a little round man in a dark cutaway coat and a neatly knotted tie. "Very good, Mr. Enslin. Follow me." The hotel manager had seemed tentative in the lobby, almost beaten. In his oak-paneled office, with the pictures of the hotel on the walls, the Dolphin had opened in 1910, Mike might publish without the benefit of reviews in the journals or the big city papers, but he did his research. Olin seemed to gain assurance again. There was a Persian carpet on the floor. Two standing lamps cast a mild yellow light. A desk lamp with a green lozenge-shaped shade stood on the desk next to a humidor. And next to the humidor were Mike Enslin's last three books. Paperback editions, of course. There had been no hardbacks. "Mine host has been doing a little research of his own," Mike thought. Mike sat down in front of the desk. He expected Olin to sit behind the desk, but Olin surprised him. He took the chair beside Mike's, crossed his legs, then leaned forward over his tiny little belly to touch the humidor. "Cigar, Mr. Enslin?" "No, thank you. I don't smoke." Olin's eye shifted to the cigarette behind Mike's right ear, parked on a jaunty jut the way an old-time wisecracking reporter might have parked his next smoke just below the press tag stuck in the band of his fedora. The cigarette had become so much a part of him that for a moment Mike honestly didn't know what Olin was looking at. Then he laughed, took it down, looked at it himself, and looked back at Olin. "Haven't had one in 9 years," he said. "Had an older brother who died of lung cancer. I quit after he died. The cigarette behind the ear," he shrugged, "part affectation, part superstition, I guess, like the Hawaiian shirt, or the cigarettes you sometimes see on people's desks or walls, mounted in a little box with a sign saying, 'Break glass in case of emergency.'" "Is 1408 a smoking room, Mr. Olin, just in case nuclear war breaks out?" "As a matter of fact, it is." "Well," Mike said heartily, "that's one less worry in the watches of the night." Mr. Olin sighed again, but this sigh didn't have the disconsolate quality of his lobby sigh. Yes, it was the office, Mike reckoned. Olin's office. His special place. Even this afternoon, when Mike had come accompanied by Robertson, the lawyer, Olin had seemed less flustered once they were in here. And why not? Where else could you feel in charge, if not in your special place? Olin's office was a room with good pictures on the walls, a good rug on the floor, and good cigars in the humidor. A lot of managers had no doubt conducted a lot of business in here since 1910. In its own way, it was as New York as the blonde in her black off-the-shoulder dress, her smell of perfume, and her unarticulated promise of sleek New York sex in the small hours of the morning. "You still don't think I can talk you out of this idea of yours, do you?" Olin asked. "I know you can't," Mike said, replacing the cigarette behind his ear. He didn't slick his back with Vitalis or Wildroot cream oil, as those colorful fedora-wearing scribblers of yore had, but he still changed the cigarette every day, just as he changed his underwear. "You sweat back there behind your ears." If he examined the cigarette at the end of the day before throwing its unsmoked, deadly length into the toilet, Mike could see the faint yellow-orange residue of that sweat on the thin white paper. It did not increase the temptation to light up. How he had smoked for almost 20 years, 30 butts a day, sometimes 40, was now beyond him. Why he had done it was an even better question. Olin picked up the little stack of paperbacks from the blotter. "I sincerely hope you're wrong." Mike ran open the zipper on the side pocket of his overnight bag. He brought out a Sony minicorder. "Would you mind if I taped our conversation, Mr. Olin?" Olin waved a hand. Mike pushed record, and the little red light came on. The reels began to turn. Olin, meanwhile, was shuffling slowly through the stack of books, reading the titles. As always, when he saw his books in someone else's hands, Mike Enslin felt the oddest mix of emotions. Pride, unease, amusement, defiance, and shame. He had no business feeling ashamed of them. They had kept him nicely over these last 5 years, and he didn't have to share any of the profits with the packager. Book whores was what his agent called them, perhaps partly in envy, because he had come up with a concept himself. Although after the first book had sold so well, only a moron could have missed the concept. What was there to do after Frankenstein but The Bride of Frankenstein? Still, he had gone to Iowa. He had studied with Jane Smiley. He had once been on a panel with Stanley Elkin. He had once aspired, absolutely no one in his current circle of friends and acquaintances had any least inkling of this, to be published as a Yale Younger Poet. And, when the hotel manager began speaking the titles aloud, Mike found himself wishing he hadn't challenged Owen with the recorder. Later, he would listen to Olin's measured tones and imagine he heard contempt in them. He touched the cigarette behind his ear without being aware of it. 10 nights in 10 haunted houses, Olin read. 10 nights in 10 haunted graveyards, 10 nights in 10 haunted castles. He looked up at Mike with a faint smile at the corners of his mouth. Got to Scotland on that one, not to mention the Vienna woods, and all tax deductible, correct? Hauntings are, after all, your business. Do you have a point? You're sensitive about these, aren't you? Olin asked. Sensitive, yes. Vulnerable, no. If you're hoping to persuade me out of your hotel by critiquing my books... No, not at all. I was curious, that's all. I sent Marcel, he's the concierge on Days, out to get them 2 days ago, when you first appeared with your... request? It was a demand, not a request. Still is. You heard, Mr. Robertson, New York State law, not to mention 2 federal civil rights laws, forbids you to deny me a specific room if I request that specific room and the room is vacant. And 1408 is vacant. 1408 is always vacant these days. But Mr. Olin was not to be diverted from the subject of Mike's last 3 books, New York Times bestsellers all, just yet. He simply shuffled through them a third time. The mellow lamplight reflected off their shiny covers. There was a lot of purple on the covers. Purple sold scary books better than any other color, Mike had been told. I didn't get a chance to dip into these until earlier this evening, Olin said. I've been quite busy. I usually am. The Dolphin is small by New York standards, but we run at 90% occupancy, and usually a problem comes through the front door with every guest.
Like me.
Olin smiled a little. I'd say you're a bit of a special problem, Mr. Enslin. You and your Mr. Robertson and all your threats. Mike felt nettled all over again. He had made no threats unless Robertson himself was a threat, and he had been forced to use the lawyer, as a man might be forced to use a crowbar on a rusty lockbox which would no longer accept the key. The lockbox isn't yours, a voice inside told him, but the laws of the state and the country said differently. The law said that room 1408 in the Hotel Dolphin was his if he wanted it, and as long as no one else had it first. He became aware that Olin was watching him, still with that faint smile, as if he had been following Mike's interior dialogue almost word for word. It was an uncomfortable feeling, and Mike was finding this an unexpectedly uncomfortable meeting. It felt as if he had been on the defensive ever since he'd taken out the minicorder, which was usually intimidating, and turned it on. If any of this has a point, Mr. Olin, I'm afraid I lost sight of it a turn or two back, and I've had a long day. If our wrangle over room 1408 is really over, I'd like to go on upstairs and... I read one of your, what would you call them? Essays? Tales?
Bill payers was what Mike called them, but he didn't intend to say that with the tape running, not even though it was his tape.
Story, Olin decided. I read one story from each book, the one about the Rillsby House in Kansas from your haunted house book.
Ah, yes. The Axe Murders.
The fellow who had chopped up all 6 members of the Eugene Rillsby family had never been caught. Exactly so. And the one about the night you spent camped out on the graves of the lovers in Alaska who committed suicide. The ones people keep claiming to see around Sitka. And the account of your night in Gottsby Castle. That was actually quite amusing. I was surprised. Mike's ear was carefully tuned to catch the undernotes of contempt in even the blandest comments about his 10 nights books, and he had no doubt that he sometimes heard contempt that wasn't there. Few creatures on earth are so paranoid as the writer who believes, deep in his heart, that he is slumming, Mike had discovered. But he didn't believe there was any contempt here.
Thank you, he said, I guess.
He glanced down at his minicorder. Usually its little red eye seemed to be watching the other guy, daring him to say the wrong thing. This evening, it seemed to be looking at Mike himself. Oh, yes, I meant it as a compliment. Olin tapped the books. I expect to finish these, but for the writing. It's the writing I like. I was surprised to find myself laughing at your quite unsupernatural adventures in Gottsby Castle, and I was surprised to find you as good as you are. As subtle as you are, I expected more hack and slash.
Mike steeled himself for what would almost certainly come next, Olin's variation of what's a nice girl like you doing in a place like this. Olin, the urbane hotelier, host to blonde women who wore black dresses out into the night, hirer of weedy retiring men who wore tuxes and tinkled old standards like night and day in the hotel bar. Olin, who probably read Proust on his nights off. But they are disturbing, too, these books. If I hadn't looked at them, I don't think I would have bothered waiting for you this evening. Once I saw that lawyer with his briefcase, I knew you meant to stay in that goddamned room, and that nothing I could say was apt to dissuade you. But the books... Mike reached out and snapped off the minicorder. That little red staring eye was starting to give him the willies. Do you want to know why I'm bottom-feeding? Is that it? I assume you do it for the money, Olin said mildly. And you're feeding a long way from the bottom, at least in my estimation, although it's interesting that you would jump so nimbly to such a conclusion. Mike felt warmth rising in his cheeks. No, this wasn't going the way he had expected at all. He had never snapped his recorder off in the middle of a conversation. But Olin wasn't what he had seemed. I was led astray by his hands, Mike thought, those pudgy little hotel manager's hands with their neat white crescents of manicured nail. What concerned me, what frightened me, is that I found myself reading the work of an intelligent, talented man who doesn't believe one single thing he has written. That wasn't exactly true, Mike thought. He had written perhaps 24 stories he believed in, had actually published a few. He'd written reams of poetry he believed in during his first 18 months in New York, when he had starved on the payroll of the Village Voice. But did he believe that the headless ghost of Eugene Rilsby walked his deserted Kansas farmhouse by moonlight? No. He had spent the night in that farmhouse, camped out on the dirty linoleum hills of the kitchen floor, and had seen nothing scarier than 2 mice trundling along the baseboard. He had spent a hot summer night in the ruins of the Transylvanian castle, where Vlad Tepish supposedly still held court. The only vampires to actually show up had been European mosquitoes. During his night camped out by the grave of serial killer Jeffrey Dahmer, a white, blood-streaked figure waving a knife had come at him out of the 2 o'clock darkness. But the giggles of the apparition's friends had given him away, and Mike Enslin hadn't been terribly impressed anyway. He knew a teenage ghost waving a rubber knife when he saw one. But he had no intention of telling any of this to Olin. He couldn't afford... Except he could. The minicorder, a mistake from the get-go he now understood, was stowed away again, and this meeting was about as off the record as you could get. Also, he had come to admire Olin in a weird way, and when you admired a man, you wanted to tell him the truth. No, he said, I don't believe in ghoulies and ghosties and long-leggedy beasties. I think it's good there are no such things because I don't believe there's any good lord that can protect us from them either. That's what I believe, but I've kept an open mind from the very start. I may never win the Pulitzer Prize for investigating the barking ghost in Mount Hope Cemetery, but I would have written fairly about him if he had shown up. Olin said something, only a single word, but too low for Mike to make out. I beg pardon? I said no. Olin looked at him almost apologetically. Mike sighed. Olin thought he was a liar. When you got to that point, the only choices were to put up your dukes or disengage totally from the discussion. Why don't we leave this for another day, Mr. Olin? I'll just go on upstairs and brush my teeth. Perhaps I'll see Kevin O'Malley materialize behind me in the bathroom mirror. Mike started to get out of his chair, and Olin put out one of his pudgy, carefully manicured hands to stop him. I'm not calling you a liar, he said. But, Mr. Enslin, you don't believe. Ghosts rarely appear to those who don't believe in them, and when they do, they are rarely seen. Why, Eugene Rilsby could have bowled his severed head all the way down the front hall of his home, and you wouldn't have heard a thing. Mike stood up, then bent to grab his overnight case. If that's so, I won't have anything to worry about in room 1408, will I?
But you will, Owen said. You will. Because there are no ghosts in room 1408 and never have been. There's something in there. I felt it myself, but it's not a spirit presence. In an abandoned house or an old castle keep, your unbelief may serve you as protection. In room 1408, it will only render you more vulnerable. Don't do it, Mr. Enslin. That's why I waited for you tonight, to ask you, beg you, not to do it. Of all the people on earth who don't belong in that room, the man who wrote those cheerful, exploitative, true ghost books leads the list. Mike heard this and didn't hear it at the same time. And you turned off your tape recorder, he was raving. He embarrasses me into turning off my tape recorder, and then he turns into Boris Karloff hosting the All-Star Spook Weekend. Fuck it. I'll quote him anyway. If he doesn't like it, let him sue me. All at once he was burning to get upstairs, not just so he could start getting his long night in a corner hotel room over with, but because he wanted to transcribe what Olin had just said while it was still fresh in his mind. Have a drink, Mr. Enslin. No, I really... Mr. Olin reached into his coat pocket and brought out a key on a long brass paddle. The brass looked old and scratched and tarnished. Embossed on it were the numbers 1408. Please, Olin said. Humor me. You give me 10 more minutes of your time, long enough to consume a short scotch, and I'll hand you this key. I would give almost anything to be able to change your mind, but I like to think I can recognize the inevitable when I see it. You still use actual keys here? Mike asked. That's sort of a nice touch. Antique-y. The Dolphin went to a mag card system in 1979, Mr. Enslin, the year I took the job as manager. 1408 is the only room in the house that still opens with a key. There was no need to put a mag card lock on its door, because there's never anyone inside. The room was last occupied by a paying guest in 1978. You're shitting me! Mike sat down again and unlimbered his mini-corder again. He pushed the record button and said, House Manager Olin claims 1408 not rented to a paying guest in over 20 years. It is just as well that 1408 has never needed a mag card lock on its door, because I am completely positive the device wouldn't work. Digital wristwatches don't work in room 1408. Sometimes they run backwards, sometimes they simply go out, but you can't tell time with one. Not in room 1408, you can't. The same is true of pocket calculators and cell phones. If you're wearing a beeper, Mr. Enslin, I advise you to turn it off, because once you're in room 1408, it will start beeping at will. He paused. And turning it off isn't guaranteed to work either. It may turn itself back on. The only sure cure is to pull the batteries. He pushed the stop button on the minicorder without examining the buttons. Mike supposed he used a similar model for dictating memos. Actually, Mr. Enslin, the only sure cure is to stay the hell out of that room. I can't do that, Mike said, taking his minicorder back and stowing it once more. But I think I can take time for that drink. While Olin poured at the fumed oak bar beneath an oil painting of Fifth Avenue at the turn of the century, Mike asked him how, if the room had been continuously unoccupied since 1978, Olin knew that high-tech gadgets didn't work inside. I didn't intend to give you the impression that no one had set foot through the door since 1978, Olin replied. For one thing, there are maids in once a month to give the place a light turn. That means Mike, who had been working on 10 haunted hotel rooms for about 4 months at that point, said, I know what it means. A light turn in an unoccupied room would include opening the windows to change the air, dusting, enough tidy bowl in the can to turn the water briefly blue, a change of towels. Probably not the bed linen, not on a light turn. He wondered if he should have brought his sleeping bag. Crossing the Persian from the bar with their drinks in his hands, Olin seemed to read Mike's thought on his face. The sheets were changed this very afternoon, Mr. Enslin.
Why don't you drop that? Call me Mike.
I don't think I'd be comfortable with that, Olin said, handing Mike his drink.
Here's to you.
And you.
Mike lifted his glass, meaning to clink it against Olin's, but Olin pulled his back.
No, to you, Mr. Enslin, I insist. Tonight, we should both drink to you.
You'll need it.
Mike sighed.